The following message is copyrighted by Westminster Theological Seminary. Duplication, distribution, or other use of all or any part of this message is not permitted without prior written consent. Please direct your inquiries to communications@wts.edu. For all other information, please visit the main website at www.wts.edu.
So that's the development of a vision. Well, let's go back to this, to the vision itself. Let me give you five things in a vision. The first one is the primacy of worship. That's the first one. The primacy of worship. A.W. Tozer calls it the missing jewel of Christianity. And I believe it's the missing jewel of Reformed Christianity, by the way. I really do. Now, I know we've got the regulative principle, but I'm not sure we've got the quality principle of being in spirit. And if we can challenge people in the area of worship that is done in spirit and in truth, and the thing that makes us enthusiastic is the truth, then there's something that can be said about our worship. It becomes exciting and attractive to people. You know, Paul says in 1 Corinthians 14 that our worship is going to have an evangelistic impact, that unbelievers are going to come into our worship service, see how it's done, and fall down in the midst of us and say, God is certainly there. I'm not sure people do that when they come to our worship services. I'm not sure that they really feel like God is there. Especially when we tell them, do you know every time the heavens are rolled back and you look back into heaven, you know what they're doing every time the prophets give us a glimpse of heaven? You know what people are doing there? Worshiping. Therefore, what we do on the Lord's Day ought to be a what? Taste of what? Heaven. I'm not sure it's a very good taste of heaven, but it ought to be. So the primacy of worship, then discipleship. Discipleship is of utmost importance. Take your Bibles, and what I want to do with you is explain to you two dynamics in the area of discipleship. Take your Bible and turn with me to Timothy, 2 Timothy chapter 2. 2 Timothy chapter 2. When we're talking about discipleship, let's look at discipleship from two categories. All right? Discipleship from two categories. The first category is the pastor to the congregation. This is 2 Timothy 2, verse 2. Let me read it for you. And the things which you have heard from me in the presence of many witnesses, these entrust to faithful men who will be able to teach others also. Now, what I believe is that discipleship has got three levels to it when a pastor works with a congregation. Level one, what do you see? You've got Paul to Timothy. That's the mature mentor working with Timothy, the maturing pastor. Level two is Timothy working with faithful men. That's the maturing pastor working with proven leaders. Level three is faithful men committing this to others. That's the proven leaders working with potential leaders. And that's a dynamic that begins with you as a pastor and works down to the congregation. I'll explain to you this, how this works out in the pattern of Christ. Let's look at it. That's the pastoral pattern. Look at the personal pattern. The Gospels and Christ's ministry. Christ had a ministry to the multitude. That Christ, you image Christ. You work with the multitude. That's your congregation and community in a discipling ministry. Then Christ worked with the 12. That was His small group of potential leaders. Then Christ worked with the 3, Peter, James, and John, His proven leaders. And then Christ probably had a special relationship with John, the one whom He loved. And I've just used that to talk about an accountability partner. Now, you put these two together in a very powerful way, and through a discipling ministry, you can develop a balanced ministry. A ministry that is balanced in all of its parts so that people are you see this 1, 2, and 3? A balanced ministry is that the congregation is winning people to Christ, and that the congregation is being trained to become like Christ, and then the congregation is sent. I think Campus Crusade, they call it win, train, send. We call it evangelism, equipping, and exhorting. So that you go out and you begin to reproduce the process. And that's really, that dynamic of discipleship is important. So it's a balanced ministry that you receive, and then you also get involved in the multiplication process because you are winning people to Christ. As soon as I talk about discipleship, everybody thinks about one-on-one. Almost everybody. As soon as I say the word discipleship. And I'm convinced that in Scripture, and the reason why, by the way, is because navigators have kept alive this idea of discipleship throughout the church history the last 25 or 30 years as we've lost it. And they talk about one-on-one discipling. But when you look in the Scriptures, take a look. One-on-one is not the emphasis. It's one to a group. Remember that 2 Timothy 2:2 passage? Paul said, Timothy, he says what? Remember the things I taught you what? In the presence of many witnesses. In other words, Paul said, Timothy, I discipled you with some other guys. Not just alone. There was a Titus. There was a Barnabas. There was a Luke. There were some other guys I was discipling. It was one to a group. And then he says, Timothy, you turn around and teach these to faithful men, plural. You get a group. And then Timothy, you challenge each one of those guys in that group to teach others. They get a group. Well, where is the one-on-one? I believe the one-on-one is an accountability relationship. And if we are going to disciple in a pastorate, we must make sure that we're being discipled. One of the first things that I did when I went to Miami was visit 14 pastors who were very successful, both inside and outside the PCA. I sat down with them and I said, before the living God, would you tell me what you believe God is blessing in your ministry? And I'm not here to criticize you. This is your opportunity to pontificate. Just talk. I'm not going to criticize at all. I just want to listen. I want to hear what you feel God's blessing you with. And they began to share, and I began to learn. Out of those two men, Jim Baird and Terry Geiger began to take a lot of special time with me and really challenge me. Terry Geiger, particularly in this area of revitalization, and Jim Baird is a model for revitalization. And as they were talking with me, they began to challenge me, they began to work with me, and I really began to learn some things in my own life. And then I became accountable to these guys where I had to report to them what I was doing. And they would ask me. And they became a sounding board. And I must emphasize, if you get into that accountability relationship with someone, make sure that you're a learner. Really learn from people. It's when we know it all that we haven't got a chance of learning anything. Well, let's go back to the dynamics again. Discipleship, then the growth mentality. What about growth mentality? The congregation needs to have a vision for growth. I picked up Randy Pope's Inquirers class at Perimeter Presbyterian. If you ever take a look at his Inquirers class manual, you'll find something. Little articles about growth are scattered throughout the whole thing. And by the time someone goes through preparation to become a member of that church, they've been inundated with a growth mentality. As I see growth in the Scriptures, these are the three areas I think growth is talking about. Number one in this triangle would be the growth mentality. Functional growth, spiritual growth, functional growth, and statistical growth. Now, what was the problem at Pinelands? See, what does everybody, when everybody talks about growth, what do they talk about? Which one? Statistical, right? That's the bottom line. Now, don't try to rebel against that because people are always going to do that. But try to get fixed in your mind and in the life of the people, exactly what are we talking about when we're talking about growth? When we're talking about spiritual growth, that's God's Word being blessed by God's Spirit that leads to functional growth, that leads finally, as a consequence, to statistical growth. And if there's a problem with statistical growth, where do you begin to look? You look back at either the lack of function in the congregation, or you look back to spiritual problems. An example would be Acts chapter 6, verses 1 through 7. Remember the rising of the diaconate? You see, it starts off in verse 1 that there are all kinds of disciples. The word of the Lord is spreading. There's statistical growth. The disciples are increasing in number. That's statistical growth. All of a sudden, a problem comes up in the congregation. The Hellenistic Jews, their widows were being overlooked in the serving of food. And they began to have a problem with that. So they went back to the elders of that church, the apostles, and they said, there's a problem, and we need a solution. Now, they were faced with coming up with a solution. What they could have done is said, okay, we'll do a better job of serving the tables. But that functional problem, if they had taken that solution, what would have happened? They would have forfeited spiritual growth. So what did the apostles say? They say, no, we've got, the danger is that we would do this functional thing and we've got to continue in this ministry of spiritual growth. We've got to give ourselves to the ministry of the word and prayer. We'll appoint deacons. And the deacons came up and handled the problem functionally. Then you come to verse 7 and you find out that the word of the Lord keeps on spreading and many of the priests were becoming obedient to the faith. Statistical growth continues. We've got to learn to, instead of, when you see a problem with statistics, instead of putting a band-aid on statistics and hyping up a program or advertising or something and say, you know, this is the way to get the statistics up. You know, we go after numbers, nickels, and noise. That's statistical growth. Say, hold it. What's the functional problem? Let's get to the root of this thing. Or is it a spiritual problem? Let's find that. When I talk about growth, I want to just say something about these three categories. Transfer, biological, or maybe we could call that covenantal evangelism. Transfer, biological growth, and conversion growth. Transfer growth is where I see most Reformed churches growing. Biological growth is just the addition of covenant children into the congregation. I believe this is what we need to aim at, conversion growth. If you're growing through people becoming converted, then you'll see transfer growth. Because people are going to come out and find out why all these people are being won to Christ. But the goal should be conversion growth. Expanding the kingdom, not us swapping members with each other. Here, you take these Baptists for a while, and I'll take the Methodists for a while, and you know, let's just swap around for a while. I really don't think that's what we aim at. We aim at conversion growth, the proclamation of the gospel. If you don't mind, let me go ahead and pick up where we left off. And I'm going to try to cover this last part very rapidly and then leave time for questions and answers. We've talked about the necessity of a vision as part of the principal dynamics of a living church. And we've got the primacy of worship, discipleship, growth mentality. Number four is a non-provincial attitude. Let me share with you something about dying churches. Dying churches are usually in the shadow of growing churches. Therefore, they have got to find a reason to validate their existence. And they usually insulate themselves with cynicism or negativism. In other words, we are, you know, people say, well, why are y'all there up the road? Everybody's going. Why is that 30 still coming to that church? And they'll usually have to come up with reasons that are negative. They don't have positive reasons. They've got negative reasons. Well, we have to keep going because that church is not faithful to the word, or that other church doesn't do a good job in discipleship, or that other church. And all of a sudden, that church is there not because of what it is, but because of what it ain't. And that's not quite accurate, is it? When we came to, that's exactly what we encountered in Charlotte, North Carolina. The church had been there for 7 years, an organizing work. It had gone on for 7 years and had grown in reverse to one family by 1980. The Presbytery evangelist asked that guy and his wife if they would continue. He said yes. He got three other families to say they'd give it 90 days. In the space of 2 years, they were able to put together a group of about 35 people. But part of the problem with those people is that in their reputation and image was negativism. They're all their advertisements. We're not a member of the National Council of Churches. We're not a member of the World Council of Churches. We don't do this. We don't do that. We don't do this. We don't do that. Now, it's good that we don't do those things, but everybody was wondering, what do you do? And people are not attracted to negativism, except negative people. And then that just eats you up. It's just a matter of time till cynicism turns on you and you are eaten up as a minister and a pastor, and the whole ministry is. That's why some churches just make it a job out of chewing up pastors. It's because of the negative attitude that's there. Non-provincial. I think this is very important for us because we have a biblical theology and we say we stand for the truth and we're identified with the truth. And we ought to stand for the truth. We ought to be identified with the truth. But it's a long way from saying we stand for the truth to the idea that we've got a corner on the truth. It's a long way to that. It's a long way of being identified with the truth so that you say to the world, you say to the world, what you do against the truth, you've done to me. That's great. That's biblical. But then we kind of put an inverse around, and the new one is, what you do to me, you've done to the truth. And that's not biblical. That is not biblical. We need to learn to stand for the truth with a non-provincial attitude. And then number five are special circumstances. I've already talked about that some in the area of vision. Look at the neighborhood, look at the various aspects of the neighborhood, and deal with those issues. The second principal dynamic of a living church is image. Image. How is an image obtained? An image is obtained in one of four ways. Let me give them to you very quickly. Number one, it's given by the community. That's one way that it's done. The community says, oh, that's the church that doesn't do this, or that's the church that does that, or this is the church that doesn't use instruments, or that's the church that... You know, they give it some kind of an image, a reputation. Secondly, it's assigned by surrounding churches. The other churches, if you don't have an image, they'll give you one real quick. Just give them long enough. They'll find one for you. They'll assign it to you. A third way is haphazardly developed. We're lazy or we're indifferent about our ministry and the way we do things, so there's a haphazard development of our image. The fourth way is for you to choose one. What is our image and reputation going to be? What am I talking about when I'm talking about image or reputation? Image, for me, is the communication of your biblical vision for the church. Remember vision we just went back over? What image is the communication of your biblical vision for the church through the lives of God's people and the presentation of the church's message and ministry to the world. Image is the communication of your biblical vision for the church through the lives of God's people. That is, they live that vision. They appropriate it in their life, and the presentation of the church's message and ministry to the world. Well, if you've got a bad image and reputation in a revitalization project, how is it changed? Well, it's changed, I think, in four ways. First of all, the faithfulness of God's people to the person and cause of Christ. The faithfulness of God's people to the person and cause of Christ. The second way it's changed is through leadership. Let me give you an example, a negative example. When I went to Miami, I went and visited in this home. We had a couple that visited, and boy, I jumped like crazy. It was one of the first visitors that ever come through the door since I'd gotten there in the last couple of months. I got to their home, and I was sharing the gospel with them, and they were not believers. And finally, he said, and I just happened to mention off the cuff, I said, by the way, do you know, and I gave him a name. I'll call him Sam Smith. I said, do you know Sam Smith? And the guy, all of a sudden, his face got red. He said, yeah, I know him. And I said, well, he's an elder in our church. He just lives a few houses down the street. He said, he's an elder in your church? You get out of here right this minute. That guy, they had a discussion where the guy had used a vocabulary and an attitude that he shouldn't have. I never got a chance to share the gospel. I never got a chance to talk with that guy because of the reputation of our leadership in that community. You and I, as leaders and our elders and deacons, bear the brunt of this matter of an image and reputation. Yes, God's people should be faithful, but the leadership should be meticulous in their faithfulness. Events and publications. When we do something or we do something, let's do it right. Please, we've got to... I'm not talking about opulence and extravagance. I'm just talking about excellence. We are tied to the tyranny of mediocrity in the church today. Do it right. We put out a bulletin that ran through a mimeograph and half of it got turned sideways and the other half got turned the other way and people come in. What do they think about our diligence? I mean, that's the first thing. I know you say that's superficial, but that's the first thing they look at. You say, God looks on the inward. Well, we're not trying to win God to the gospel. He gave us the gospel. Men look on the outward and they won't look to the inward till they see what it produces outwardly. I've got some publications down here. And if any of you want any of them, I'll make them available to you. Just put your name and your address down. I'll make them available to you at $4. And there's a couple other publications I'll throw in. Just to give you an idea. You do your own thing. This is just an idea. I encourage you to write Randy Pope for some of the stuff he does. I did. And really, really helped me. You don't have to reinvent the wheel. There's nothing copyrighted down here as far as I'm concerned. I'm glad if it helps. Number four is a church name, motto, and verse. Now, don't laugh. I laughed the first time I dealt with this. Church name. That's the first thing that hits people. Now, I'll go ahead and give you our philosophy. The name of our church is Christ Covenant. I chose Christ Covenant with the elders. We prayed about it, looked at it, and let me say, they chose it, and I really appreciate it and affirmed it. And the reason why is, number one, it gives the centrality of our ministry, Christ, and it gives some of our dimensions with the word covenant. And you don't even have to put the word church with it. We never use the word church with it. I mean, we're a church. Everybody knows we're a church. We're listed in the church section. Why put church with it? That's just taking up space. Christ Covenant. That's the way it's known now in Matthews, North Carolina, and Charlotte, North Carolina. It's Christ Covenant. And we don't have Presbyterian. If you look at our pastor's class, you'll see we clearly teach what we are. But we don't make people grapple with that right up front. We make people grapple with that we stand for Jesus Christ. And then as they hear the gospel of Jesus Christ, they see that, hey, did you know that if I'm going to be biblical, I've got to believe in the plurality of elders governing the church? If I'm going to be biblical, then I need to deal with the issue of the sovereignty of God and the responsibility of man. See, we don't communicate our distinctives up front in the sense of we put them all on our signs out there. Our distinctives are communicated because they come from the truth. They're communicated through the ministry of the truth. And that's how people are changed in that area. Mottos are great. I used to not. I thought it was kind of superficial and childish. But it's just a succinct statement that your people can give to people. Our motto is this: developing disciples for God's glory. Developing disciples for God's glory. And in that motto, we're telling people we've got a balanced ministry. We're developing disciples, people who follow Jesus Christ. And the purpose of our church is not for its own existence, but for the glory of God. And then the last thing we put in for image is a verse. We have a church verse. We've chosen Colossians 1:18, that in all things Christ would have preeminence. And because we want people to know that Christ, the reason we're there is for the exaltation of Jesus Christ and Him alone. We're not there for the pastor. We're not there for the church. We're not there for our denomination. We're there for the glory of Christ. So those are just some helpful things in terms of development of image. And then finally is a powerful pulpit ministry. Charles Spurgeon says that the Thermopylae of Christianity is the pulpit, and I agree with him totally. People are not going to drive 5 miles past 10 churches for coffee and donuts between Sunday school and worship. They're just not going to do it. You know, when I got to Florida, I went around to all those guys, and they all had little distinctives. Like, I went to Coral Ridge and Evangelism Explosion, and Jim Baird was the training of leaders, and David Nicholas was small group dynamics, and Terry Geiger was discipleship groups and evangelistic Bible studies, and Ross Baer had his own. And I saw all these guys had distinctives. Two things I saw about successful churches. One is they all had distinctive. The next thing I saw is that every successful church had a better than adequate pulpit ministry. I know a church down there right now that is its evangelistic program is winning people to Christ at an amazing rate. And they're only assimilating 1 out of every 10 into the church. And they have an assimilation program. The elders have finally come to the conclusion, and they're challenging the pastor. The reason people are not staying is they're not being fed. They're being won to Christ, but they're having to go somewhere else to be fed. It's just milk. Well, that's pretty much in the area of principle dynamics. That's not all of it by any means, but I just thought I'd give you those. And then let me wrap it up with this. Two final words. The first thing I want to do is I want to give you a perspective. I want to give you two perspectives in these two final words. The first perspective is on people. I find a lot of pastors that go into revitalization projects deep down inside disdain the people that they're coming to pastor. And it shows up eventually in the ministry. You've got two ways that you can look at your present congregation as you move to your potential congregation. Are they a scaffold? Or are they a foundation? In other words, are you just standing on those people till you can build your new vibrant congregation and using them? Are they the foundation of the potential congregation? Now, if they're scaffold, then some will be part of the new church, some will be dismantled and go away, and others will just stay there. And you ever seen scaffolding on a new building, what it looks like? Not too good. I know a pastor right now went through a very difficult time, And the reason why is he took the scaffold approach. He said he took these 60 or 70 people and he was going to stand on them till he built this new vibrant congregation, but he didn't really minister to them. He used them. The new congregation came, but the old congregation didn't go away, and the church is now hopelessly divided. The old and the new. When I went to Miami, the first thing I did was visit every member in that church. Do you know what I found out? I'll just give you one illustration. One family I sat down that had been members of Pinelands for 23 years, and they told me, they said, "Pastor, this is the first time that a pastor or elder has been in our home in 22 years. I then looked up all the people that had left the church. And that was too many. So I got the ones that had left the church. I didn't know where they went. And I started visiting them. About 100 families. 10 of the families were reclaimed. Believe me, the parable of going after the one and leaving the 99 became real to me. 10 of the families were reclaimed either through conversion or rededication to Christ. And two families were put back together who were in divorce proceedings. I believe you have a duty to pay the unpaid bills of the previous failing ministries. You've got to go do it. For the credibility of what you want to do, you can't just use those people. They're the foundation of the new work. I believe that with all my heart. The second thing is the perspective on evangelism. Is it supplemental or fundamental? Well, I think it's fundamental, obviously. It's a rhetorical question. I think it's fundamental. I want to conclude with just a very brief... Now, we do a lot of things in evangelism. Maybe I can answer your questions later. We got a program called LEAD. We got a program called Table Talk Evangelism, Hospital Evangelism, Bible Study Evangelism, Fisherman Bible Fellowship Evangelism. A bunch of them. I'll be glad to share with you the various things on evangelism. I'll tell you the thing that... I'll tell you the thing that sold me on evangelism. When I got to Miami, guess where the first marketplace for evangelism is in a revitalization project? It's your local church. There are people there that aren't saved. The first Sunday I was there, I was preaching on saving faith. Now, I had this worked out, this new worship service. And when I got to the end of this sermon, the organist, and choir director was supposed to begin playing. She was supposed to play the hymn, and I was going to talk to the people, etc. So I got to the end of the sermon, I bowed for prayer, and I said, and I began talking, but the organ didn't play. And so I kept talking, and I said, every head bowed and every eye closed. I got every head bowed and every eye closed, but I couldn't get any music on. And so I kind of looked out of the corner of my eye over there, and I said, and I was just panic-stricken. My first Sunday, it was falling apart right at the end of the sermon, everything. I was just all upset. And then all of a sudden, I finally opened one eye to look toward the organ to find out what was going on over there and try to tell her to start playing. And I heard sobbing, and I looked down in front of the pulpit, and there was the organist and choir director with tears streaming down her face, saying, she said out loud, "Pastor, I need to be a Christian." So I know what to do. I didn't even give an invitation. There she is down there. So I walked around the side, went down and said, "I'll talk to you in just a minute." And I closed the service in prayer. The next day, one of my deacons came to me and he said, "Pastor, I wanted to come down front. Why didn't you ask anybody else?" And I said, "Well, Jack, I just didn't." But he said, "Well, I need to be a Christian." He said, "I'm not a Christian." And I said, "Well, Jack, you don't have to come down front. You can become a Christian right now." He said, "Okay." So he gave his life to Christ. And then when we finished, I said, I never even understood what saving faith was. And I said, "Now, Jack, that's great." And he said, "Now, Pastor, I want you to give an invitation next Sunday because I want to come forward." And I said, "Well, Jack, now you don't need to do that." He said, "I need to do it." He said, "I've been living a life for 14 years. I need to make it public and right." And I said, "Okay." That Thursday, Jack cut his thumb off with a power saw. Had it sewed back on with microsurgery. Had to put a button in the end of it to hold it in with a string toward one of his bones in his wrist. Sunday morning, I looked out there, and there was Jack, arm wrapped, 6 inches around, straight up in the air, sitting out in the worship service. The end of the service, I didn't expect him to move. The guy's in pain. I didn't expect him to move. I gave an invitation. Jack got up, started coming forward. When he did, his wife grabbed him by the coat. She came. Right behind her came the chairman of the diaconate and his wife. Behind them came two elders and their wives.
Well, the next Sunday, I didn't have to be talked into giving an invitation. 26 people came forward and made a commitment to Jesus Christ. There was no doubt in my mind that revitalization was taking place through the gospel. We began to see people, their lives changed. A couple came in that had been living together. They came in, the first young couple, really young couple that came in. He's 6'5", narrow waist, big shoulders. She's a beautiful young lady. They went out the door. I jumped on them just quick as I could. I said, "Hello, glad to have you." They said, "Glad to be here, love the preaching, et cetera, et cetera." I went back, checked the guest book to make sure they'd registered, and I got back there. There it was. There was their names, and there was the address. Same address, different last names. I went into their house and shared the gospel with them that week. They became Christians. 3-4 weeks later, they dealt with the issue of their sin and living together with a public worship service, inviting all of their friends, in which they had me read a public statement of their repentance. I thought, I didn't know what I was running that church for a while there, because then I began to look out over the congregation. They kept bringing their friends. They had all these couples coming that were living together. And it was exciting to see what the Lord was doing. The gospel was at the core of revitalization. There's a lot of things I wished I could share with you, and I've gone over a bunch and skipped some things, but I'll try to answer any questions now that I can. Yes, 10. Pray for a rotation system? let's see. Tim, you know, I'm not sure, brother. I think there's a certain element. You really have to be led by the Spirit of God in dealing with that issue. I think there are certain people that I know God can use me to change, because He's used me with that kind of person before. And there are some that I know I can't change. And I think I'd have to try to make that decision in terms of the candidating procedure. And if I feel like I'm not really qualified or gifted to handle that kind of a person. I think leadership's absolutely important. You know, and leadership's got to be with you. So what I do is I just give a brief statement of the things that I am going to try to do by God's grace, and are they going to commit to them? And then I ask them to give me a statement of what they want from me. And we really try to deal with that issue up front. And sometimes a church just has to keep dying for the leadership will say, "Hey, we need to change." I know that's, I don't mean to be cruel in that, but sometimes it just has to happen. John? Yes. The question is, would you do that before you accepted the call? Yes, I would do that before I accepted the call. And, really spend some time in prayer and ask them to pray about it before you come. Yeah. Okay, I mentioned the elective Sunday schools. We have a thing called Sunday Bible School in which we offer electives. I don't believe that. My own personal opinion is that people don't like to be divided by age or sex. And they like to, it's better to let them divide themselves by interest. And we have home rooms in which the homogeneous groups can get together, younger and older and singles and all of that. But then we have our Sunday Bible school is actually electives in which we offer an Old Testament elective, a New Testament, some topical study, usually a video course, the pastor's class, which everybody must take before they become members. That's one of these things over here is the pastor's class manual. And usually a training program, because you have to take a training program before you can teach. And by the way, let me say that there's a study on church growth, and it was found that the churches with the highest standards were the ones that grew the fastest, for leadership particularly, the highest standards for leadership. My own personal opinion is I meet a lot of people that want really vibrant churches, and they raise the standard of membership. I don't think that's right. I'm going to hear a book of church order says credible profession of faith, not credible profession of faith plus. But I believe if we raise high the standards of leadership and raise the standards of expectations of the members, then I believe the church really begins to grow. And elective Sunday Bible schools are a good way to do it. Yes, sir. Well, brother, the only thing I know that I would do is, number one, I would sit down with this brother in terms of what negativism and cynicism does to a people from the leadership. When all said and done, people become like their leaders. And I just share that principle with him and just say, brother, this thing is just eating me up. I think it's eating other people up. I really want us to work together. But this is just something I just can't handle. And I don't know what to do about it. It's really something that we need to deal with. Let me suggest one form of dealing with it, though. I have found in ministering to people that if I can get them to see the problem without identifying the problem with them, they sometimes are willing to deal with the problem. If I can get a brother to see what cynicism and negativism does to a church, then many times he will see that he can't be that way and should not be that way. We do our best to make it as unattractive as possible to be negative. I mean, I will say things like, you can probably get away with adultery quicker than you can gossip. Not because I like adultery, I hate it. But because I think gossip is one of the most destructive sins into the body of Christ that you can, you know, adultery, when it happens, you know it, you can deal with it, you can handle it, and it's between two people. Gossip, you ever try to track gossip down? I mean, it's absolutely impossible. And we have people, we have a thing in our membership application that we call a loyalty vow, in which people vow never to give an evil report to anyone else about anyone else. And if they do, they will be disciplined immediately. Their responsibility is Matthew 18. They go to the brother privately. So we try to make it as unattractive as possible. And then I constantly make the leadership aware and myself aware that we've got to model for these people what a positive, growing, exciting life it is in Christ. To draw people to that. So I think if you can put the problem of negativism and cynicism out here and go to this brother and say, you know, I've found what this does to the church. How can we get rid of this in our church? Besides getting rid of you. You know, how can we get rid of it in our church? And then you may share. I share publicly, very clearly, how God dealt with this in my life. It's a little humiliating, but it helps people see that it needs to be dealt with. Does that help at all? Okay. Any other questions? Feel free to ask them now. I don't want to. I think you try to make a determination whether you're talking about coming into the remaining group, not the group that left, but the remaining group. Okay. By the way, let me say something about revitalization I didn't say a while ago. Right now, what I'm in is kind of a combination revitalization, organizing. We don't have any land. I can't tell you how much I appreciate the fact, looking back, what it was to have a building to grow into instead of having a growing church with no building. Because it's so hard in terms of ministry. So, you know, when you've got that existing, that is a, revitalization projects are very attractive in some way. One of the ways you already got a facility to grow into, which I would be very thankful for. As far as the remaining group that's left there in a split situation, how to get the vision positive with these people, how to get them to adopt a vision. Sure. You got to get
together, fragments, get everything back in a positive direction, revitalize that, unify
it. Yeah. Well, you got it. I mean, you're on your way there. I think, you know, you've got to preach on that issue. I think you've got to preach on that issue in terms of handling, once again, the problem of negativism. I think you've also got to seek reconciliation as much as possible between the two groups. That has to take place.
The whole idea there, though, that principle of reputation and image, and just what you're talking about.
Right, right. And to reverse that, I think you want to make sure that the group that you pastor is seen as harboring no ill feelings, desiring the best for those who left, willing to go the second mile, willing to ask for forgiveness. I think that must be known. You know,
at the same time, though, as you want to reorganize and revitalize that church into a growing entity, glorifying the Lord, that it's given by the community or some assigned by the surrounding churches, all those elements as a result of the gospel.
Yeah, brother, and I'm not saying you can rebuild it in a day or a month.
I'm just trying to begin.
Yeah. Well, you know, that's exactly what I would begin to do, is just taking those positive steps and getting this, because as long as they've got these feelings toward those people, they're never going to be able to grow. And that has got to be healed as far as you can take it and as far as they can go. If the other people won't heal, that's between them and the Lord. But as far as you can take it, and then you turn around and say, all right, now we're free to begin to minister. And people, I think people begin to see, it takes a while, but people will begin to see that, you know, your mind is not on that, your heart's not on that, you hold no ill feelings about it. And one of the things we do, for instance, to show people our positive spirit as well as fulfill a biblical commandment, is I publicly in the pastoral prayer pray for the churches around us. and for their success. One of our churches that is the large, not ours, but one of the largest churches in the area, a Bible church type situation. You know, it's like sometimes I think to whom much is given, much more is given. They've got about a $12 million plant and they've outgrown it. And so the Lord gave them 100 acres free. And I just told y'all the story about our 31 acres that we're seeking the Lord for. And I had a little trouble dealing with that, to be honest with you. But one of the ways I dealt with it is in the pastoral prayer that next Sunday, I prayed for God's blessing upon them and their stewardship of that, and called our people to pray for them on a regular basis. Also, at the end of the pastor's class, I say, now that you know what Christ's covenant's all about, I said, here's a list of churches that you might feel more at home in than this one. And, you know, I'll just go ahead and recommend the ones in the area that are standing for the Word, even though they know that we're different in our theology. But I want people to know that we're not going to judge them if they leave or anything. And, you know, to become a part of us is volunteer, not I'm afraid. I got to become a part of y'all because y'all have made me afraid to join anybody else. You know, and I just don't think that's healthy at all. So we put a list up, and I encourage people to, if they want to try those churches out. One guy came out one Sunday. He said, man, this is great, preacher. And he said, but I just moved here, and I don't want to go to the first church I visited. I know I shouldn't ask a preacher, but are there any other churches that you can? I said, sure. I said, we cross-pollinate with a lot of people around here. And I already had a list prepared for him to take it on. And he couldn't get over that. And that reputation gets around, by the way, that you're not grinding an axe against other churches. Gets around very quickly. And besides that, I think the Lord honors it. Yes, sir. Brother, I tell you, I made a mess out of my ministry for 6 years. That's the way I learned. And I would give anything if we could do something in this area. It's become more pointed and painful to me as I've thought about being with you guys this week. My own personal opinion is that a lot of men are being trained for pastorates that they won't get until much later, if at all. And that's why they struggle so hard, because they're facing things that are not what they were taught in the classroom. And I think we got, I mean, I'm a graduate of Westminster, so I think we got some of the greatest instruction in the world. I think this whole dynamic of revitalization has not been faced. And it is the condition of most churches, and it is the most likely pastorate for the men that graduate and go into a pastorate. And even the people that are here that come out and go into church, most of the time they'll get into some churches in some form of decline. So, you know, I just think in the context of practical theology or in the context of evangelism or somewhere, we've got to develop something that addresses this issue. What do you do when? And I wasn't really even taught how to deal with a session, much less with a cantankerous session. And I think these things have got to be addressed, and I wish I had an answer for you. I don't. I know some way that, I think the internship program is a good approach, but usually it's only the successful churches that can afford to bring the interns in, and so the guys don't get to see that. And by the way, let me mention something else. I really believe what I said earlier about organizing pastors. I believe that organizing pastors, there ought to be a great amount of training before a guy starts off as an organizing pastor. Because of the unbelievable pressures in that situation.